I just wanted to go over some ground rules with you, Amy. First of all, I'm asking the questions. So we grew up on Long Island in a pretty ordinary American suburban community, went to the local public school. Bayshore was the town. How did that plant the seeds for what has been a pretty extraordinary journey to, as you often say, going to where the silence is?
Well, first of all, David, thank you very much for doing this. You might notice we might have a few dueling interviews as we go through here. And to Ken, I want to say thank you for that really wonderful introduction. And I hope you all tune in to WDEV for all the great shows, from NASCAR to the Red Sox, from The Kid in the Geezer to David's weekly show. And occasionally, I hope you tune into Democracy Now! Every day at 5:30. So, well, I mean, first of all, David, I was very inspired by Dave's Press. And even though David is my younger brother, my older brother, Steve, was 2.5 years older than me, David 2.5 years younger, and then our youngest brother came like 11 years later, Dan. But when David, how old were you when Dave's Press started?
I was, I think, 7 years old.
Okay. So David had a newspaper that he put out from his bedroom. And this went out to the greater good people community. It was the old Xerox machine. Was it Xerox? Where he would put all his weight pressing down and one image would burn into the next. And it was sort of a glorified family calendar. Very interesting, like, except that sometimes he would write, like, on this day, Mom spanked Amy, and then she put her foot down and said, no dirty laundry can be aired, because David had many subscribers, our grandparents, our great aunts and uncles, but the letters to the editor page was wonderful. It's where everyone weighed in, and I remember when our grandfather, Saul Goodman, wrote in to David about the Vietnam War. He disagreed with one of David's editorials. And David wrote back, Dear Grandpa, thank you very much for being my first subscriber, but your views on the war are stupid. And then our great uncle Joe wrote, Shema, that's what he called my grandfather, how could you possibly criticize your grandson? And this is, you know, it would become the debate of the family. And I think I was the envelope stuffer, and we would, and my brother was the, he collected the subscriptions.
He was the publisher. We called him the publisher.
He was the publisher, and I think I was dunning people for the penny subscription per year, and I would put the newspapers under each door. We all lived upstairs, my parents, and then each of us, and then we would send them out, and I would send the bills to people. You owe 3 cents you haven't paid in the last 3 months, whatever. But it really was, I mean, David was incredibly dedicated. He got very busy. I don't know what sport you were playing, or he was playing clarinet. And so then the newspaper started to come less frequently. So we would have double issues and then triple issues. But they really discussed the issues of the day. And there were signs all over the house, Dave's Press, arrows to the upstairs. That inspired me. Also, our dad was the head, and it's, I think, really instructive now on the 60th anniversary of Brown v. Board of Education. My dad was in charge of a task force. He was an ophthalmologist in town. He was a founder of the chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility, PSR, and my mom founded the St. Fries chapter in Long Island. There was a big issue of Newsday that talked about the plowshares activists of Long Island, and they were featured in this. But he led a task force to integrate the schools of our community. I mean, we lived in a diverse community, but essentially we had de facto segregation. depending on where you lived, which meant some schools would be white and some schools would be black. And he led this task force to integrate the schools. So it wasn't based on neighborhood, but if you were in first grade, you went to this school. If you were in fifth grade, you went to this school. And so we were all together. This was not very appreciated by many people in our community. So I would follow him. I think I was in fifth grade. He would take me to, I think you were sleeping, it was in the evenings. He would take me to the cafeterias and the auditoriums. There would be 1,000 screaming parents. And I would watch as he very judiciously led our community to a more just solution in education.
That idea that you often speak of going to where the silence is and the power and role that journalists can play. Moving to today, you know, when we grew up, I vividly remember the picture that we had of journalists was as fighters for truth. I mean, the things that shaped our images of what journalists could do were the Pentagon Papers in 1971, Daniel Ellsberg, a contractor for the RAND Corporation, finds this secret history of the Vietnam War. It reveals that the Johnson administration had been lying to Congress and the American people. The New York Times and the Washington Post published this. I remember this big photo on the front page of the Times of all these lawyers for the newspapers going to the Supreme Court to fight to allow a allegedly independent media to publish this information. A year later, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein start the series that becomes the Watergate scandal that brings down a president. Fast forward to today, Edward Snowden, a contractor for the National Security Agency, reveals that the U.S. government is illegally spying on our phone calls, our email, and if we were to just connect straight back to the early 70s, we would think, well, this is a whistleblower, this is a hero, he's done this as a service. But something very different has happened. Describe, and you have had on incredible interviews with Glenn Greenwald, really the main, who just won the Pulitzer Prize, who has been the conduit for Snowden's work. But and this week, for those of you who want to hear some of the most compelling Democracy Now! Stories, Amy's interviews with Glenn Greenwald, which cover two shows, where he talks about it's like a cloak and dagger spy movie, what it took to simply be a journalist and tell these stories. What has happened to journalists today, like Greenwald, where he is getting slammed in editorials in the major media, not to mention being a whipping boy for Fox News and others, as a traitor who should be arrested and tried?
Hmm. People like Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras. To think about what they did and what they risked to bring out this information, not to mention Edward Snowden. I don't know how many of you how many of you heard the interviews with Glenn this week? And I hope everyone else, you can tune into democracynow.org and you can just go to those two interviews and watch them. It's really amazing. You know, Glenn Greenwald is a remarkable journalist. Laura Poitras is a filmmaker, and I had known her for a few years. We had her on like 2 years ago when she came on the show with a top NSA official named Bill Binney and another hacktivist, peace hacktivist, you know, computer activist, and talked about how much trouble they have just coming in and out of the country. This was 2 years ago, before Snowden. Laura, doing films on Iraq and Yemen, was stopped like 40 times coming in and out of the airport. And when she would try to write down the questions of her interrogators' customs at the airport, they would threaten to arrest her, etc. And you don't usually think about this when it comes to the United States. And then you have what happened a year ago. You have Edward Snowden. This was actually in the midst of the Bradley Manning trial. Bradley, who's now Chelsea Manning. Bradley Manning, at the time, he is this low-level Army intelligence officer in Iraq and somehow manages, getting on a computer, to download the 60 years of documents from the State Department, all of the Afghanistan war memos written by soldiers and officers, as well as Iraq. It's astounding what he was able to do in the desert in Iraq. He is taken, you never hear his voice again. And you know, in the midst of the trial, and he was charged with releasing them to WikiLeaks, Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. Julian Assange, who's in the U.S., in the Ecuadorian embassy now, holed up there in England and is coming on the second anniversary of that, releasing this information. The key that was so astounding when Manning was tried at Fort Meade in Maryland at National Security Agency headquarters, you never could hear his voice. Democracy Now! Broadcasts his voice because someone secretly recorded him testifying. Who would have thought that would be such a revolutionary act? But Edward Snowden saw all this, saw if he tried in this country to release information, would he possibly be able to release that information? We're supposed to protect whistleblowers. Now, who is this guy, Edward Snowden, right? He, Glenn Greenwald just wrote a book called No Place to Hide, which, by the way, that title of the book comes from the Frank Church, Senator Frank Church hearings in the 1970s when Senator Church, the Idaho senator, was going after the abuses and the excesses of the CIA and the FBI and said, my God, we're going to have no place to hide. That was 40 years ago. Now, 40 years later, Edward Snowden realizes, being a contractor, that he can read President Obama's email. I mean, here's this kid. I was amazed when I watched the networks and you had the pundits and politicians, Congress members, saying, how dare this high school dropout? And I thought, wait a second, that says much more about the U.S. government that a high school dropout can read the email of the President of the United States. Right? It's much more an indictment of U.S. government and secrecy and how we protect our national security. And this is what he was concerned about. So who is he? He's a kid who does drop out of high school. He goes on to, after 9/11, he's very disturbed, and he signs up to be in the special forces. But in the process of his training, he breaks both of his legs, and he's not a very good candidate. So he goes on to be a security guard at an NSA building at the University of Maryland in College Park. The students don't know it's a NSA building, but it is. He then goes to work for Dell, and he's starting to see, he's a very smart guy, 27, 28, and then 29 years old when he does this, how much he has access to, that he can spy on any American he wants to. And he thinks this is wrong, that this violates everything he understood what it was to be, you know, a patriotic American. And if he can do it, a high school dropout, you know, who else can do this? And he goes on to work at for Booz Allen Hamilton as a contractor for the NSA. And he now realizes he cannot be quiet any longer. But how is he going to most effectively release this information? If he doesn't show the documents, he'll be called a liar. If he shows them in the United States, he'll probably be arrested immediately. They will be seized and no one will believe him. So he decides to go to Hong Kong. And he communicates with Glenn Greenwald, who's a columnist for The Guardian, and Laura Poitras. He also communicates with The Washington Post, but they decide they won't let their reporter risk everything that the Washington Post has built to go to meet with this person in Hong Kong. It's very interesting that it's the independent reporters that go, Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, and they didn't know what could happen. They went to Hong Kong, and they met this person. They didn't know if it was a man, a woman, young, old, what their color was, what their height was, who they were. They met with him. Glenn is also a lawyer. He had been a litigator, and he questioned him for hour after hour after hour because he needed to know if this guy was for real. And then he showed the documents, and they definitely believed him. And they did this interview. Laura's a filmmaker, and they posted online at Guardian. They wrote the pieces, and this changed the world. President Obama, first they denied it, right? until he showed the documents, right? Clapper before the Senate. They don't have to, these top officials do not have to testify under oath. I don't know if you knew this. They don't put up their hands like others who testify. And he said it wasn't true. Of course, he then was forced to take that back when the documents were shown. And President Obama said it's very important that this debate has been open, but it had nothing to do with Edward Snowden. And they are going to try Edward Snowden for treason if he comes back, and espionage if he comes back into this country. Under the Obama administration, they have prosecuted more whistleblowers than all presidents combined. And Snowden goes underground in Hong Kong after he talks to them, and then he realizes he has to leave. He is going to try to get to Latin America, where he's been offered asylum. But as he flies out, and this is all the sort of problems with the press, challenging the misinformation that comes out. He didn't want to go to Russia. His passport was pulled when he left Hong Kong, and he had to go in transit through Russia to go to Latin America. And so he ends up in the Russian airport, and he can't leave because he has no passport. So he's granted asylum there, and the rest is history. He has now spoken through Skype and video chats in various venues and said, I'm not even about social change myself. He said, I am just about giving information to the American people so that you can decide what we want our country to be, to represent. Do we want to be a national security state? Are we making ourselves more secure by spying on not only the American people, but on world leaders, like on the president of Brazil, the chancellor of Germany, etc.? The comparisons to Dan Ellsberg, you know, at the time he was vilified. And the very same types and probably people themselves who vilified him now say, well, Dan Ellsberg is a great whistleblower, but Edward Snowden is a traitor. And Dan Ellsberg saying, no, Edward Snowden is me in the future from what I was in 1971, but a lot braver, Dan Ellsberg says about Snowden. So I think it's really what we're seeing today is an establishment press that is challenged Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras as much as, you know, the head of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers, who's now going to quit to be a radio talk show host, who calls journalists like Glenn Greenwald a thief and says he should be prosecuted under the full extent of the law. I mean, Glenn Greenwald is doing what journalists should do. You know, David and I wrote a book called Static, and the reason we called it that is because the media should give us the dictionary definition of static: criticism, opposition, unwanted interference. We need a media that covers power, not covers for power. We need a media that is the fourth estate, not for the state. And we need a media that covers the movements that create static and make history. And the reason that Edward Snowden is so important, and what Glenn and Laura have done is so important in getting this information out, and how they differed from WikiLeaks. By the way, the way Snowden got out of Hong Kong was because Julian Assange holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy because he's been granted political asylum by Ecuador but can't leave the Ecuadorian embassy in London, or he'll be arrested by British authorities and extradited to Sweden. And he's concerned that if he's sent to Sweden, that he will then be extradited to the United States. And we know what happened to Bradley Manning. It was Julian Assange holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London that made it possible to get the tickets for Edward Snowden to leave Hong Kong. It is absolutely astounding if you've ever thought if an individual can make a difference and the pressure that these people are under. Now, I just want to quickly comment on the Pulitzer Prize. It's very interesting what happened with the Pulitzer. A few weeks ago, you know, both Laura and Glenn were afraid of coming back into the United States. There was so much discussion of the possibility that they could be arrested for being accomplices to a traitor, accomplices in espionage. But they were winning one of the highest awards in journalism, the George Polk Award. And what could be a better time to challenge this than to fly in at this point to get the award? I mean, if they're going to be arrested then, that would be a very sad comment on the Obama administration. So they flew in, and they were able to get this award. So Glenn came back this week because he wrote this book, No Place to Hide. But 3 days after they got the George Polk Award, the Pulitzers were announced. And who won? Well, The Guardian and The Washington Post won the highest Pulitzer Prize. It's called the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service. And then other individuals won for best feature, best breaking news, everything else. They weren't personally named. Yet think about what they did. Why didn't they personally? Now, it's a very big deal. Glenn wrote for The Guardian, and Laura wrote for both The Guardian. She co-bylined The Guardian and The Washington Post. Now, the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service usually goes to an institution. How could the Pulitzer Committee avoid giving an award for this astounding series of articles? They couldn't. But clearly there was a battle within the Pulitzer for the establishment media that cannot stand Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald, and those who felt that they must be recognized. I mean, what could be a higher value in journalism than what they represented? So there was this battle, and so they gave it to the institution, to the Washington Post and to the Guardian. Now, if you click through on the websites of the Pulitzer, it shows the articles. Glenn Greenwald, Glenn Greenwald, Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, Laura Poitras, and Laura Poitras is also the Washington Post, Laura Poitras, Laura Poitras. So they are what got these institutions these awards. Even with giving it to an institution, as the Pulitzer for the Public Service is, it will often say, you know, to the New York Times with taking special note of the bravery of this reporter, but they didn't name those reporters. But still, you know, technically, you must say they were part of a team that won the Pulitzer Prize as opposed to Pulitzer Prize winner. But, you know, we certainly call them Pulitzer Prize winners. And when you look at the other names, there are some very wonderful journalists who are part of it, and they themselves would say, you can't put me in the category of Glenn. Glenn's the one who risked his freedom, risked everything to go and cover the story, as Laura did. So that's very interesting. And as Glenn said also, though congratulating both institutions for being willing to back them in doing this work, Glenn said it was also a battle between old media and new media, you know, still giving to the more establishment publications. But it's these two independent journalists that have just broken the sound barrier every which way and continue to do this. What they did differently than WikiLeaks is WikiLeaks did one dump of the information, which can lead to a couple of stories. It's so overwhelming, you know, who is going to be able to really go through it. And what these guys are doing is learning from that. And the lack of coverage overall, though you certainly know about WikiLeaks, is releasing these stories over time, one by one, so each one has an effect and has certainly changed the discussion about surveillance, about privacy in this country.
And what's so remarkable is to see these institutions, both in politics and in media, this has caused a war within themselves. So Obama is forced to acknowledge the NSA is breaking laws and there are excesses, but these people who told us about it, they're really the ones who should, you know, Snowden in exile. And within the pages of the New York Times, you have Bill Keller, the former executive editor, before the Jill Abramson just fired as the only woman executive editor.
In the 160-year history of the New York Times.
And Keller editorialized frequently on the criminality of Snowden and got in a public debate with Glenn Greenwald about the ethics of what he did, while his paper is selling a lot of copies with those stories.
And just to say, finally, I mean, we were from the beginning of Democracy Now!, but finally the New York Times in their editorial pages said they would call Edward Snowden a whistleblower.